I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Jolie Justice is running for mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, and if you've forgotten just how popular she is, she won her city council seat by an overwhelming majority in April's primary. We'll see if that popularity holds. Today, we'll ask Justice about her role in the new KCI Terminal Project on creating more affordable housing and how best to fund pre-K. We'll also ask her about her out-and-in-again approach to the mayor's race. Then, this weekend, Kansas City hosts a celebration of National Girls and Women in Sports Day. To mark the occasion, we'll get a sense of the progress girls and women are or aren't making in the pro and amateur sports they love. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Many insiders believe the early frontrunner for Kansas City mayor is Jolie Justice. The former state senator turned city council member has been a close ally of Mayor Sly James on a new terminal for KCI and for a number of major projects around town. The race has already been somewhat tumultuous for Justice. She was in the race, then dropped out when Jason Kander entered. When he unexpectedly dropped out, Justice quickly jumped back in with Kander's backing. Justice is the director of pro bono services for the law firm Shook, Hardy & Bacon, and she joins me here right now. And Jolie, welcome. Nice to have you again.
It's great to be here, Steve.
You know, some people question just how committed you were to the race to become mayor when you dropped out when Jason Kander got in. What happened there? I mean, why not stay in the race and fight for the office, even with Jason also running?
You know, the most important thing to me was putting Kansas City first. And so when Jason came and told me of his plans to run for office, I immediately talked to my family, my team, my campaign team, and to a lot of the folks who had been supportive of my race. And we made the decision that the most important thing right now is to keep our city moving forward. And having Jason Kander and Jolie Justice running against each other was not a good idea.
Why?
I was going to be spending a lot of time and energy in this race, frankly, targeting Jason Kander as opposed to building up the city and my record of getting things done. So I wanted to make sure that I put the city first. The other thing, frankly, Steve, is Jason and I have a lot of the same ideas and pull from a lot of the same bases. And our concern was, my concern was, that we might beat each other up and then have someone come in who didn't put the interests of the city first. And so I really wanted to make sure that we had strong leadership and I was willing to step back and support his campaign. And when the opportunity came to get back in, I made that decision immediately and got back in.
I mean, why not make him step aside?
You know, that is absolutely something we could have done. We had several conversations, and in the end, I'm the kind of person who is a collaborator. I'm the kind of person who always puts the city first and my family first, and that was a decision that I made that I think was in the best interest of all of us.
So you get back into the race. There's already, what, 11 candidates total now in the race. Why not put Kansas City first and not get in the race and let someone else do it and not divide the city any further?
Well, you know, the same answer is there. Jason Kander and I had the exact same vision for the most part for the city. Not the exact same vision, but very similar. I feel, though, that when you look at the folks who are in this race right now, that I am different than the rest of the pack. I'm someone who has shown an ability to lead, to be effective, to get things done. I've got a significant experience in Jefferson City on the legislative front. These are skills that are going to be incredibly necessary to keep our city moving forward. And I think that I bring a perspective to this field of 11 that doesn't exist elsewhere.
But Steve Miller has some Jefferson City experience. Scott Taylor would sit here and probably say, hey, I've got certain experiences that are worthwhile as well. What about that?
Sure, I understand. Everyone brings a very unique set of experiences to the table, and I appreciate it. And we have an amazing field of candidates. The work that I did in Jefferson City was unique from the other folks who have similar experience. I spent 8 years in the deep minority in Jefferson City, the last 2 years as the minority leader of the Missouri State Senate. And in that time, I created relationships that allowed me, even though there were only at one point seven Democrats out of 34 senators, I was able to get things done. We passed legislation legislation that impacted not just Kansas City, but impacted people across the state of Missouri. And I created relationships that are still alive today. I'm excited to report that three of the men that I served with in the Senate and had very close relationships with are now the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general of the state of Missouri. Mm-hmm. We didn't always see eye to eye on a whole lot of issues, but we got together and worked on things that were important for the state. And that's the type of relationship we need, is we need a mayor who can be a collaborator, who can get things done and work with people regardless of partisan, regardless of geography, regardless of all of these things. And that's what I bring to the table.
You know, when you were in Jeff City, I think it was pretty broadly reported that you won kudos from members of both sides of the aisle for your work as Senate Minority Leader. What did you learn about working with Republicans in that experience that might apply today to the federal scene or if you become mayor down the road?
I think the first thing that you do is you drop all assumptions about people. And that's a really hard thing to do in politics. But I think a lot of times people come into a situation, whether it be partisan or polarized for some other reason, people make assumptions about what the other side is thinking. And the first thing I do is try to find what is something that unites us. What is what brings us together? And then when you bring it down to the local level, and this is really why I want to run for mayor of Kansas City, what's happening at the big city level is really keeping the whole country moving forward. And so I wanted to make sure, and this is what I learned down in Jefferson City, that regardless of whether I'm on opposite sides of someone in a polarizing discussion, that I find out where we connect, mm-hmm. because these local issues are something that we can really unite on. And so those skills were incredibly important. And I really learned how to drop assumptions and then just make sure to listen and try to meet in the middle. Became a real pragmatist while I was in Jefferson
City. So slowing down, taking a little time might have been things you did to make that work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about Jefferson City is things move very, very slow. I have had people say to me, how do you sit through some of these, you know, candidate forums or committee hearings that you sit through? And I said, I've sat through filibusters in Jefferson City that last days. I am trained to do this. And so, it's not always fast. It's not always easy. But when you have a good idea and you have people who are all working in the best interest of their constituency, you will get to something that works.
So back here at home, what kind of job has Mayor Sly James done? What's your sense?
I think Mayor James has done a fantastic job. He's clearly been an amazing ambassador for Kansas City, going out, really raising our profile, taking on some tough issues that needed to be tackled that, frankly, a lot of folks didn't want to tackle. What are those things? The airport, the general obligation bond to start to really get after some of the infrastructure that's been pushed aside for years. Those are big picture things. His profile on the national level also helped us pull in some federal dollars for some needed projects that we've had. Those are all incredibly important things. He was a catalytic mayor at a time that we needed it, and I'm really excited about the momentum that the city has right now under his leadership.
You know, you watched him pretty closely. What would you do differently?
You know, it's interesting. I'm actually a completely different type of leader than Mayor James is. I am someone who is a little bit slower moving. I can be very quick when necessary, but I always bring kind of this idea that I want to bring all of the voices to the table and sit down. So I have a little bit different leadership style.
Some might relate that to Mayor Kay Barnes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think that's different. I think also while it's been amazing to focus on all of these big picture ideas, and I want to continue to do that, I also want to have a different focus of sorts. I want to be focusing on making sure that this momentum we're feeling citywide, that we break it down to the community and neighborhood level. And so I have, and that's really frankly, Steve, because I got my start on a neighborhood board. I mean, the first time I ever really got involved in sort of this community service outside of the pro bono legal world was when my neighborhood association asked me if I would be on the board. Mm-hmm. And so I understand the importance of making sure that this momentum that the city has right now is felt in every single neighborhood, wherever it is in the city.
You know, some say that Mayor James, his critics say that he pushes a little too hard sometimes. He has a hard edge to him at times when he's not getting how he thinks should play out. He's not getting what he wants. And you're saying you're a little different than that, if I'm hearing you right.
My style is I'm a little more collaboration, a little less agitation. And I think one of the things that's important for leadership and leadership transition is that every leader builds on the person who was there before him or her. And so one of the things that I do bring to the table that I think is different is just sort of a more of a diplomat, more of a kind of a problem solver. And I am excited to kind of take the baton and move on to that next form of leadership, because I think every successful city that we've seen across the country has had that sort of succession where you go from one leadership style to the next, and they're all important.
Councilwoman Jolie Justice is my guest. She's a candidate for mayor here in Kansas City. You know, you're a big backer of the mayor's early childhood education program that's on the ballot in April when the primary election for mayor is going to be. Why is it so crucial that this program be passed in your view, Jolie?
So, and to make it clear, and I just want to make sure, I was not at the table for forming this plan. And so just like every other Kansas Cityan, I've had to go out and do my research on this. And I've come to the decision that I'm voting for this pre-K tax. And here's why. I spent 8 years in Jefferson City, as we've already talked about. And most of the years that I was down there, I introduced legislation for universal pre-K. I did that because my work representing kids and families in the foster care system and the juvenile justice system, I quickly learned what everybody knows in the education and the science community, that it matters. What you do between age 0 and 5 is very important. And a lot of the long-term issues we're talking about in this city, they can be addressed by making sure that kids are kindergarten ready. So, number one, we have to focus on early childhood, quality early childhood education. Number two, Jefferson City, Washington, D.C., they're not going to pay for it. It is becoming a priority, and I'm absolutely thrilled about that, but it's still not making budgets that the governor gives us, even though he knows it's a priority,
right,
because they have huge budget shortfalls this year. And so we need to come up with solutions locally. And this is a solution that is limited in time. It is 10 years. It is a sales tax, and it is means tested, which means that our most vulnerable kids, the ones who can afford quality education the least, are going to be the ones who benefit. And I'm willing to take a bet on that.
You know, its critics say two things about this plan. School superintendents oppose it, and the way the plan would be funded would be through this 3/8-cent sales tax that would hit Kansas City's poorest the hardest. How do you address those concerns and square those concerns with your own backing of it?
You know, I understand that sales taxes can be regressive. They are regressive, and I understand that. And because of that, I have fought sales taxes for other reasons over the years. But I will tell you this, when we are using the vast majority of this funding to help the poorest in our society, to me, that is something that is worth it. It is going to return its benefits and then some. And so one thing that I have to say to those folks who are against it is I understand, and there are going to be times when we're on opposite sides of the issue. But whether this passes or not, the first thing that I want to do as mayor in the space of education is pull everybody together to talk about how we can either make the plan work because it's passed, or how we can start talking about what we're going to do next to make sure that not one more generation of 3- and 4-year-old kids falls through the cracks.
I was going to say, if this goes down, you're saying you'd make it a priority from day one to get something passed.
I don't know what it would be, Steve. If this goes down, I mean, it's obvious that we're not going to come back with the exact same plan. But I would sit down with the superintendents, because many of them have said they have great ideas, and I want to talk to them about those ideas.
Why not let them lead this parade instead of the city being involved in leading it?
Oh, I think that that's absolutely a fantastic idea to let them, you know, lead the parade. But the problem is that we haven't had anything yet. So I'm willing to give this one a shot. And if it goes down, then let's have them step up and figure out what we're going to do next.
You've also been intimately involved in the push for a new single terminal up at KCI. You know, to the casual observer, and maybe to anybody, the process has been a mess right from the get-go. Give us an update right now on where things stand up there.
Absolutely. So we are in the process right now of waiting for the airlines. The airlines are taking a look at the total cost, and they're taking a look at the allocation of the cost to make sure that they have a complete understanding of what the entire scope is going to be. They are negotiating amongst themselves right now on, number one, is the total cost what they want it to be? And number two, how they're going to share those costs, because as we've talked about incessantly, they are the ones who are paying for it with their revenues, and then they're also backing the debt. And so this is a huge project. It's one of hundreds of projects that they have across the country and even the globe. And so decisions that they make here have ripple effects throughout the entire industry. And so we are checking in, not just daily, but hourly with the airlines now. And we feel like they are really on the cusp right now of making a decision about how they're going to share their costs amongst themselves. And then they will be able to bring that decision to the council, and then the council can make a final vote on the overall project.
You know, again, the mayor made you and put you in charge of this thing. Again, this has been a difficult process. Some might wonder, is this an example of your leadership style?
You know, it has been a difficult process, and I've joked often that it was probably my own fault, because the mayor asked me when I first got elected what I wanted to work on, and I told him anything but Kansas City International Airport.
I'm laughing. I've heard you tell this story before.
Yeah. I really was focused on making sure that we had more direct flights in and out of Kansas City. I wanted a safe, modern, and convenient airport, and I wanted to make sure we had more flight options, because our city needs that. As I learned more about how airports are financed, about the very specific issues that we have facing our community, it became very clear to me that we need a new single terminal. We need a better front door to our community. All of our businesses and potential businesses who are looking at Kansas City say we need to get this done. But most importantly, the airlines want to expand and make more flight options for current and future Kansas City residents. And so I have learned and become a huge and passionate supporter of getting this done. Of course, it's been messy. This is the biggest public infrastructure project our community has ever had. There are layers upon layers of difficult issues facing Kansas City that are unique in the fact that we had a public vote, for instance, in the fact that it's a city council rather than an airport authority, a regional airport authority that governs the airport. All of these are unique situations, and we are getting it done. We are going to have a new single terminal at KCI. We will make this happen for the community. And when we're all able to be out there on the day that it opens, hopefully we'll be able to say, okay, yeah, this was a tough process. We learned a lot from it. And now we're going to have our, you know, kind of the fruit of our labor.
You know, it is the largest project in city history. And early on, you were standing behind the mayor's. He was ready to award $1 billion no bid contract to a local firm, Burns and McDonald. I mean, what about that? I mean, why didn't you suggest right then and there that this was the wrong way to go? That and counter, you know, that was counter to one of the most basic tenets of good government, that you bid out a project of this magnitude.
Sure, I appreciate that very much. You know, one of the issues that we had facing us over and over and over again was how we get this across the finish line with the voters, because the voters, no matter how many times we talked about it, were concerned about what would be the ultimate cost to taxpayers. And so when the idea came forward from an amazing group of hometown folks, we were excited about that opportunity. The first thing I said to the people who came and pitched the idea to me is, go sell it to the council, get those 7 votes, let's sell it to the community to see if we can get it passed. And it was very clear very quickly that that was not a good idea. And so that's why we switched at that time.
Why wasn't your initial reaction to go out and bid the project? It's a $1 billion terminal up there.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's exactly what we did. This is a learning process, Steve. We're not always going to make the right decision on the first time. And we didn't do that. And so we are, I think, on the right track. Not I think. We're on the right track now. Mm-hmm. We have an amazing project with a great developer, and we're going to get this thing done. And it wasn't an easy process. But because we were all working towards this one goal, I think we are absolutely on the right track and looking forward to see the end result.
You know, what would Kansas City look like, Jolie, after 4 years of Jolie Justice as mayor of this city? How's it going to be different?
Well, I think a few things. Number one, I've talked a lot about the importance of Kansas City's momentum right now. Mm-hmm. And we've got this national profile. We always seem to be on some top 10 list for, you know, whether it's, you know, visiting or, you know, quality of life. And I want that to continue. So I want strong leadership to make that continue. But I also want a city that 4 years from now, no matter which sidewalk you're walking down in which neighborhood in our 319 square miles, that you're looking around and feeling that same sense of excitement and buzz. And that's starting to happen right now. When you look at the ripple effects of our successes, some of the east-west streets right now that are really becoming catalytic, whether it's 18th or 27th or 31st or 63rd, we're really starting to see this excitement. And that's because we've been doing a lot of work focused on entrepreneurs and small business, and making sure that we give the private sector the tools they need to succeed. Mm-hmm. And then as City Hall, sometimes what we need to do is just get out of the way. And so I want to see more of that. So 4 years from now, what I would like to see as mayor of Kansas City is, number one, a city that is continuing to be on the rise nationally, but one where everybody feels better connected and that they're really just enjoying the benefits of it.
You know, one of the issues that seems to be creeping up on the city's agenda more and more is affordable housing. You heard some of those concerns last night when you talked to UMKC students who are concerned about staying here and can they afford to live here. What's the path forward there? Where would the money come from for affordable housing? You hear this talk about a $75 million trust fund. In the same breath, members of the council say they don't know where the money for that would come from, but it's an idea out there. How do you move forward on this issue?
I think you have to kind of piece it together, and it can't just be there's not one answer to the whole problem, obviously. Right now, we have a lot of affordable housing in the region, but it is so disconnected from where people need to be, whether it's school or job centers or public transportation
right.
options. So we need to focus on making sure that we have a plan and that we are implementing an overall strategy. And right now, it's just kind of when an idea comes in the door, we try to push it forward, but we don't really push on where it is. So one thing is we need to make sure that we are better connected with the affordable housing options. And then the second piece is let's come up with some ideas on how to get money into that trust fund, because a trust fund is a good idea. These are things that the federal government used to make available to communities that we don't have anymore. And we need dollars to do a lot of things, whether it's helping individuals stay in their home with minor home repair, or whether it's helping a neighborhood association take an abandoned house, get it repurposed, and then get someone back into the house. We need those types of options, but we don't have that available. So I'm going to be folding out a plan soon that has some ideas on how to get money into that, and substantive money. And some of it can start with the incentives that we're giving away right now. When someone comes in and says,
redirecting some of those?
Yeah, I think that what we can be doing, and there's conversations taking place today about whether we set aside affordable housing stock in every incentivized housing project. And that might be something we could talk about. But for the times that it won't work, maybe they have to make a payment in lieu of that. Mm-hmm. And that money would go into the housing trust fund. When I was in Jefferson City, I worked on a similar housing trust fund concept. And we were always looking for ways to get money into that. It was the Missouri Housing Trust Fund. And it started by putting just a very small fee on every time someone filed something with the recorder of deeds. Hmm. We have opportunities like that right now in Kansas City, and we need to explore all of those options to get money into that fund so that we can start being very intentional. But we need a plan before we make that happen.
You know, it's amazing the extent to which the state, the governments across the country, for that matter, the federal government, have sort of backed away to some extent from helping cities move forward. Cities really are on islands more so today than they've ever been before.
We really are. When you look across the board in Kansas City and the things that we are picking up that used to be done by other folks, I mean, frankly, the state of Missouri has not been able to keep their obligations to our roads and bridges, and so we're picking up the slack there. Obviously, when it comes to health care, the people of the Kansas City region have said we're willing to tax ourselves in order to provide indigent health care. And we're doing that. But that's the importance of big cities right now, is we are really taking part and taking care of people in a way that the federal government used to do, but they just kind of dropped the ball.
Okay, that's Councilwoman Jolie Justice. She's a candidate for mayor in Kansas City. She'll be on the April ballot. Thanks for coming in, Jolie. Always nice to have you here.
It's great to
Appreciate
be here, Steve.
It.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about women's sports. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, multi-genre recording artist Damien Snead discussed his 36-city We Shall Overcome tour. It honors Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Hear what he had to say at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the city of St. Louis and St. Louis County are considering a merger. We'll find out if Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County have anything to teach them about that process. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Olympic gold medalist Simone Biles is coming to Kansas City on Friday to be the keynote speaker for the Kansas City Win Luncheon, aimed at encouraging girls to play sports. Just so you know, this is the largest luncheon in the country celebrating National Girls and Women in Sports Day. That makes it a perfect time to talk about area women's sports and women in sports in general. With us, Jessica Blueball is the director of Win for KC. Jessica, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Greg Eklund covers sports for for KCUR. Greg, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, Jessica, last night was State of the Union night. President Trump gave the big speech. Give us a State of the Union, if you will, on how women are faring in sports these days, from the amateur to the pro ranks. What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress, obviously, since the days of shortly after Title IX passage. We've seen tremendous amount of growth and participation at the youth level. Last year saw the largest amount of high school girls participating in sports ever. So
are there groups that track numbers like that?
So yeah, you can the Women's Sports Foundation puts out some really good research on tracking participation and the benefits of participation, what comes from that.
Is that participation, is it growing year after year? Are you seeing steady growth that way?
Steady growth, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think they continue to see prevalence in girls who don't participate by the age of 14. They're really inclined not to participate after that. And at the age of 14, you see double the amount of dropout rates that you see from boys.
That's interesting. So the percentage of boys who participate in sports compared to the percentage of girls, do you have a rough idea?
I don't know that statistic right off the top of my head, but it's significantly different. I mean, boys have significantly more opportunities and are more likely to take advantage of those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. But again, the gap is probably closing.
Yeah. Hopefully, yes. That's the idea.
Yeah. Greg, what's your sense of women in sports these days from a macro a 10,000-foot view here?
I think as a sports reporter who's on the scene, I'm seeing a tremendous growth on the amateur level. There is growth on the professional level, but I would say that there's still plenty of room to grow on the professional level.
What's holding the professional level back?
I would say that a lot of it is TV exposure and sponsorships. Because you have your women's professional sports that have been around for a while. Just to throw out one, the LPGA has been around for a long time, but the LPGA just doesn't seem to grab the attention of prime network spots to be televised or getting the top sponsors for its tour.
How about the WNBA, for instance? This is basketball season. What do you see there?
Well, and that's a great point, Steve, because you say this is the basketball season, but the WNBA plays in the late spring and through the summer. And
so away from when the men play.
Sure. And now NCAA, on the NCAA college level, they're at the same time because this is the women's college sports season for basketball as it is for the men. So you have to wonder, is it in the best interest for the WNBA to be playing at that time or to be playing now? And then, again, it comes down to television availability and sponsorships.
Mm-hmm. TV being key, as always, to these
absolutely
to the exposure factor. Yeah. Jessica, what are you seeing when it comes to the popularity of women's professional sports? What catches your eye?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's some big milestones that we hit in 2017 and 2018 in terms of professional sports. In terms of viewership, I think you have a significant growth in certain sports, but I think you still have like diehard fans who are really big fans of women's basketball, women's softball.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you've seen tremendous growth in some of those other newer sports.
Has the growth been what it should be, or is it still lagging in your view?
I would say it's still lagging. I think, to Greg's point, I mean, I think some of it is about when those seasons are taking place, and if they're not congruent with when the male version of that sport is happening, then it's not getting the same attention that it's out there.
Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Which of the professional sports have proven to be the most successful for women?
I mean, I think obviously LPGA, I think golf is one that's transcended generations, as is tennis. Tennis is one of the most longstanding professional sports out there and has taken place for, you know, really long time. Billie Jean King is a trailblazer in terms of driving awareness for women's tennis.
You know, is women's tennis professional tennis, Greg? Yeah. Is it on par with the popularity of men's tennis, or is it fairly close?
I'm saying it's fairly close because of the Williams sisters.
Yeah.
They have taken the sport of tennis to that level of being so close. And I'm going to throw in another sport that I think has really come a long way. It may not be the most talked about, but I'm going to say MMA.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is, for women's sports, has really taken off.
Why?
I think, on the grassroots level, we're seeing it in the state of Missouri right now. Girls wrestling. And sometimes it evolves into sports like boxing or MMA.
You're nodding your head as he's talking, Jessica.
Well, it's interesting because we offer a camp for girls, and when we talk to the girls about what they're most excited, what sports are they most excited about doing, we offer wrestling and football and rugby, and some of those contact sports are the ones that are most popular with little girls.
Why is that?
I think it's because...
That surprises me, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised. I admit it. You know?
Well, I think it's probably a number of variables, right? But and we don't have any like empirical data to point at this. It's all anecdotal, but it's being able to look, you know, have an environment where a little girl can go in and experience something that maybe she's never been given the opportunity to do that before. Maybe there's the connotation that it's negative for her to do so, that it's not a positive thing for her to experience. So being in an environment where she's surrounded by other little girls and women who are encouraging them to do that, I think it just opens all kinds of doors.
You know, Danny Alexander, our producer, just suggested that equestrian sports, women compete at the highest levels. So there's pro tennis, where women and men are fairly even in terms of popularity. What other professional sports would you include in that group then?
I'm going to say it may not be as popular here in this country because even the men struggle with it. But overseas, I would say that women's track and field, there are some international meets in Europe that pay a lot of money. And there are some top caliber Americans who make a lot of money with track and field overseas.
I wonder if a sport, I mentioned Simone Biles is going to be here for your luncheon, if women's gymnastics sort of exceed the popularity of men, that might be one that comes to my mind.
Absolutely. I think the popularity of women's gymnastics far exceeds the popularity of men's.
And, why would that be? I mean, why is that an exception here?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm asking hard ones. I recognize that. Yeah.
I mean, I think you know, when you talk about the Olympics and you talk about that time of year, you know, people are paying attention to all of the sports that are being played during the airtime of that. But when you're talking about and I think predominantly like gymnastics is probably I would say it's sort of a sexist perspective, right, to say it's like predominantly a women's sport. So I think that's probably leaning in some direction. But again, I'm not an expert on that.
You know, what's the role that an Olympic win can have in promoting women in a sport? What do you see?
In terms of win for KC promoting?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, when Kansas City hosts big events like the U.S. Gymnastics Championships that are going to be here in August of this year.
That's going to be a big deal
downtown. It'll be a big it's an Olympic qualifier. So the people who win at that are going to the 2020 Olympics. So I think when we bring women's sports events to Kansas City that can help elevate the awareness of certain sports, that is ultimately helping drive popularity and exposure and things like that.
You know, one more different area here, Greg, women as owners, agents, coaches, referees, and umpires, even in the professional male ranks. What's been the progression you're seeing there?
I think a great progression there. And some of it is not just happening today or yesterday. Some of it has gone back a long way. To throw out a couple of examples, the NBA was the first to have women's referees among the I should say baseball had Pam Postma in the late 1980s as a baseball umpire. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been a female umpire since, I don't believe, but it's hard for any umpire, male or female, to break into the major league profession on that level.
And speaking of the NBA, there's the announcer, the woman who's terrific, and is one of the big names.
Well, Pam Ward is one that comes to my mind. She does a lot of men's sports, and she's excellent.
It's the TV broadcaster. By catching everybody blank here, yeah, she's wonderful. Whoever she
is. Well, there are some really talented female play-by-play announcers as well. But getting back to what you were saying before, as far as officials, administrators, KU has one of the top strength and conditioning persons in the country, Andrea Hootie. When you talk about the strength of KU basketball players, Andrea Hootie, who is renowned across the country for her work, is the person behind the scenes on that.
Yeah.
Well, and I think like when we're talking about transcending like career paths, like Jessica Mendoza, right? Like she was a professional softball player. She was immensely successful in her sport. She then transitioned that experience as a broadcaster in softball into the baseball realm and is doing professional baseball. So I think that's an example too.
So is there any area that the walls haven't come tumbling down when it comes to women's participation in sports or owning a team? Or is there anything that's any frontier left out there?
I would say Becky Hammon came very close to becoming the first women's basketball coach in the NBA when she was a finalist for the Milwaukee Bucks job. She didn't get it, and actually the Bucks are one of the best teams in the NBA.
So a head coach right in the NBA or the NFL, that would be...
Right, okay. Although that, now there are assistant, there are women who are assistant coaches in the NFL.
How's that working out?
I haven't heard anything negative on it, and there was an NFL referee this year. The first female NFL referee was on the field this year. Her name was Sarah Thomas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to move on a little bit here. Joining us now is J.C. Hoyt. She's the head coach of the UMKC women's basketball team that's now in second place in the Western Athletic Conference with a 5-3 record. J.C., welcome back to the show. It's nice to have you again.
Yes, always love being on. Thank you for having me.
Well, how's the team doing these days?
Well, we're doing okay. You know, we got off to such a hot start in conference, and it's been a really fun ride. We dropped a couple at home in our last couple games on Thursday and Saturday.
That's not supposed to happen, JC.
I know, right? I'd protect home court. They didn't get that memo. but no, we played two really great teams, and honestly, I think they are two of the better teams in our conference. So, you know, it's really important for us with such a young team that we just get better every game. And I think that although we came up short, we still got better and learned a lot in those two games. But when you ask me how I'm doing, I'm never good after a loss. So, the next game can't come soon enough.
Well, you know, we're talking here with our good panel about women in sports. And I'm wondering, from your vantage point, are you seeing more women coaches at the college level these days, JC? What are you seeing?
You know, I would say I honestly haven't seen a whole lot. It seems like they're always coming out with articles, you know, and things change every year. But without a doubt, I think that we are definitely advancing just as a whole. And, you know, at the NBA level, we've got Becky Hammon and Sue Bird kind of as our trailblazers. And so, you know, every day in college athletics, it seems like women are kind of doing new things and doing great things to advance themselves. So it's been fun. It's been fun to just watch. And, you know, I look so much up to Pat Summitt, who really started everything off for us as females.
The coach of Tennessee for so many years.
And so she gave us a great example, you know, and unfortunately she's no longer with us, but I think we all feel a great duty and responsibility to really kind of step up and fill that void that she left.
But what would be the singular challenge, JC, of a woman coaching an NBA team?
Well, I think it's really just kind of the common sense idea that you're with a bunch of males. And, you know, you look at Title IX and all of that stuff. And the bottom line is we just got a later start because we weren't allowed to do so many of the things that men were able to do. And so I think that, you know, males just kind of look at it and they say, okay, well, why, you know, we've had males, they were the ones who started this. They are the ones who have played it longer. So why would we bring in these females? And, you know, it is a little sticky and tricky when you get into locker room settings and stuff like that. But I mean, I don't see any reason not to bring them in. I think that it really shouldn't matter. You know, you always should evaluate people just off of their knowledge and their skill set. And I think that there are a lot of females out there who certainly are capable of coaching at the highest level.
Would J.C. Hoyt one day possibly be interested in coaching an NBA team?
You know, honestly, Steve, my heart is just, I have such a passion for young women and having that influence and impact on their lives at this time in their life. So although I would be honored and I think that would be incredible from a basketball standpoint, my passion is really just young females.
Do you have any interest in coaching at the professional level at all?
No, I really don't. You know, I would say for me, it goes back to who made the biggest impact in my life. And that for me, that was always my college coaches. Mm-hmm. It was my high school coach as well. It was my mom. So I don't know if she counts.
I remember that.
But she certainly does count because she's, you know, just an incredible coach and taught me so much. But I would say for me, just like I said, having people impact me at the college level really has just given me a strong desire to do the same for my players.
You know, besides, you know, improving their games, what do you hope playing the game teaches the women on your squad?
Oh, man. I mean, I think this game just teaches so much about life. And, you know, it's a game of error. It's a game that's going to throw so much adversity at you. And I think that that's the best tool that we can give our players is just, you know, hey, things are going to get hard. Refs are going to make bad calls. You're going to have bad games. The other team is going to go on a run. You're going to have to push through being tired. You know, all those different things that the game throws at you, I think, look very similar to what life is like. And to have to push through that adversity. And we talk every day about toughness. And for us, that's a core value in our program. And for us, toughness is not just physical toughness. It's also mental
right.
toughness.
I was going to say, is there a magic formula for pushing through toughness, JC?
A magical formula? Well, I think a lot of people just, you know, it comes down to heart. And we really try and recruit kids that play with their whole heart and, you know, hate to lose and love to win and just competitors. So I think that a lot of it honestly happens in your recruiting. But then as a coach, once I get them, I think it's my job to kind of place them through right. those adverse moments, you know, in practice and in mm-hmm. the things that we're doing off the court to try and build that up in them.
That's J.C. Hoyt. She's the head coach of the UMKC women's basketball team. Always appreciate your time, Coach. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the WIN luncheon coming up on Friday. What's going to happen just in 20 seconds?
Sure. WIN for Casey has been hosting this luncheon for the last 25 years, and it's really held all around honoring local girls and women for all that they have accomplished and contributed to Kansas City in sports.
More information about the luncheon at sportkc.org, right?
WinForKC.org or SportForKC.org.
Okay. That's Jessica Blueball. She's director of Win for KC, and Greg Eklund covers sports for KCUR. Thank you both very much for coming in today. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there certainly wasn't much action in last Sunday's Super Bowl, but that wasn't the case at casinos in several states where gambling on sports is legal for the first time, thanks to a landmark Supreme Court ruling that you might have missed. Tax collectors and investors stand to make millions, but is it good for the fans? Commentator Victor Wishnow weighs the odds in this month's edition of A Fan's Notes.
Did you bet on the Super Bowl? I bet you did. And by you, I don't mean you, but the estimated 23 million Americans who did, which might include you. And if you did, there's a better chance than ever before that you did so legally. You see, last May, the Supreme Court decreed that a long-standing federal ban on sports betting was unconstitutional. That opened the door for legalization in all 50 states, that is the 49 not named Nevada, where sportsbooks have been booming for more than half a century. Seven more states have already made it legit in the last 9 months, and ESPN's handy online sports betting bill tracker assesses which states could be next. And that's almost everywhere, including here. In Topeka and Jefferson City, new proposals have hit the statehouse floor already. It's a great bet for local coffers, of course. All those new sportsbook profits, you know, all the money that gamblers like you lose, means millions in new taxes that could go to things like infrastructure and education and veterans programs. So, except for the losers, everybody wins, no? We'll see. Because the high court ruling and the massive new market it has launched will also alter the lives of American sports fans, whether they wager or not, changing the ways games are watched and even played. You think I'm exaggerating? I'll take that bet. With eight states now on board, legal betting on Sunday's Super Bowl more than doubled over last year to some $325 million, but that's a fraction of the estimated $4.6 billion that skirted the law. According to one independent research firm, if in-person and online wagering were available nationwide, sports betting could generate $16 billion in revenue. That's more than all current sports merchandising deals combined, according to PricewaterhouseCoopers. So how long before the tail wags the dog? In the age of data overload and instant online action, sports betting is set to transform the fan experience more than electric lights or TV ever did. Each game offers thousands of proposition bets, not about who wins or loses, but how they play the game. Live feeds could look more like stock tickers, with individual stats and odds scrolling along in real time. On some new regional sports networks, they already do. Proponents downplay the possibility of corruption and gambling addiction. But the real madness begins next month, when the men's Final Four will draw more than twice the bets of any Super Bowl, more than $10 billion worth. Is there no obvious iniquity in authorized wagering on the exploits of unpaid amateurs? No one involved denies the risk, but it's far outweighed by the dollar signs. Indeed, it's a little creepy how quickly commissioners and owners have gone all in. Leagues now have official deals with casinos and sites like FanDuel and DraftKings. Las Vegas is building a shiny new stadium for the Raiders, who, it says here, still play in the NFL. One sports owner wants to revive the Arena Football League as a gambler's bet dream. Your favorite team will be whichever one is winning you money that day. I understand the appeal. Like fantasy sports, the rise of in-game betting gives fans more reason to care, something to literally invest in during those lopsided games where one stat, the score, has lost its charm. And it allows those watching to feel more like participants and less like just fans. As the Action Network's Chad Millman told the New York Times this week, fans have become more opportunistic about their fandom. They think about winning individually, not about rooting for a team. And maybe that's why it's rubbing me the wrong way. I know it sounds cheesy, but there's no I in team, right? And there's no I in fan either, at least for those who believe being a fan means being part of something bigger. I don't begrudge anyone the thrills that sports can bring, or even the profits. But as life as a KC sports fan has taught me, I've got enough at stake. I bet it all on you. Every
time. Every time. Victor Wishnev is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Yesterday on the show, the multi-talented Damian Snee described his musical celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. coming here this weekend. You can hear that story and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, I'll look at the proposed merger of St. Louis County and City through the lens of the unified government of Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.